Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. As promised, Jimmy Akin, Weird Questions this hour. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. And when we say weird questions, well, maybe you could think of a weird question or something, but we do these. People send us weird questions, and so we get an accumulation of weird questions. Some sent to Jimmy's email, the various other ways people get written questions to us. Sometimes have you ever just written down a verbal question somebody gave you?
No. But I will sometimes ask on Facebook, or people will email them to radio@catholic.com, and then they're forwarded to me, and I put them in the log.
And we've got them all collected up for you. And as I go around to various places, people tell me all the time their favorite hour is Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin, which I guess there's just a lot of weird people in the world.
Yeah.
So Jimmy is senior apologist here at Catholic Answers. His latest book is The Bible is a Catholic Book. You can get that right now at shop.catholic.com. It's from Catholic Answers Press. You ready for some weirdness, Jimmy?
Oh, sure.
All right. Patrick, by email, asks this. There are certain acts which have an indulgence attached to them. Let's say a woman named Mary is in the habit of a particular prayer at a particular place and time. One day, Mary explains her habit to Martha. Martha exclaims, "Did you know there's an indulgence attached to that?" "No, I didn't," Mary replies. My weird question is, does Mary receive those indulgences retroactively with this knowledge and desire, or has she been unconsciously receiving them all along, or is it the case that only going forward she will receive the indulgences? Wow.
Or none of the above.
Oh, so maybe something that he didn't think of. I like that it's in story form with little quotes and stuff. So thank you, Patrick.
So the church doesn't have a teaching on this, and that means we have to fall back on theological reasoning to try to formulate our best guess answer.
Okay.
According to common theological understanding, in order to obtain an indulgence, you have to have the intention to gain it.
Okay.
So if you knew, for example, that saying a particular prayer has an indulgence attached and you say, "I don't care," then you're not going to get the indulgence. Mm. And so according to the standard interpretation, you have to have the intention. And that brings up the fourth possibility. When Martha tells Mary, "Did you know that there is an indulgence attached to that?" Mary could say, "I don't care." In which case she's not going to get any indulgences even going forward.
Okay, yeah.
Because she'd have to have the intention. Now, it is commonly also understood, though, that the intention does not have to be conscious. It can be what's called habitual. And this applies not just to indulgences, but to lots of things connected with sacramentals and sacraments and so forth. Basically, what's called a habitual intention. Also, sometimes you'll hear the phrase virtual intention is one where you have the intention, but it's implicit and you may not be thinking of it at the moment.
Okay.
So, for example, a priest doesn't have to think every time he baptizes a baby, you know, this baby is about to be regenerated.
Oh, I see.
But right. He has to have the intention in a general way of doing what the church does. He doesn't have to consciously think about the particulars.
Which is good, because you wouldn't want him later, like, lying awake at night, did I baptize that baby or not?
Exactly. And that's why God doesn't require conscious, explicit intention for things, because it would create nightmares for us.
Yeah.
So according to the common theological understanding, if Mary, once she learns there's an indulgence attached to a particular act, if she then forms an intention to, you know, say, I would like that indulgence, whenever I say this prayer, then at least going forward, she's going to have it until such time as she might revoke her intention.
Okay.
But the question here is, what about the past?
Mm-hmm.
Because she has not been aware of this up to now, and thus certainly did not have any conscious intention at any point of acquiring it. It's not like she had one and it's in the back of her mind somewhere. She did not have one. So some theologians might look at that and say, well, she'll have it going forward, but it doesn't really apply to the past. Others might, though, say, well, if her will is such that that she says, oh man, I wish I had known that, because I would have done it all along. then that could be taken as evidence of an implicit intention that she has had all along.
Oh.
Of, well, she would have wanted this if she'd known about it, and now she knows about it, so it becomes an explicit intention. But there was already an implicit desire there, kind of like baptism of desire can apply to people who don't even know they need to be baptized.
Mm-hmm.
It's like if you would have willed to get baptized, if you had known that's what God wants, then God can give you the grace of baptism early, even though you've never even heard of baptism. And so you could say, well, if the principle of implicit desire works for baptism, it could also work for indulgences as well. And so if someone would have wanted it, would have wanted to gain an indulgence from a particular action, then God knows the state of that person's heart. And so some theologians could look at it and say, well, then that person would have been gaining them all along. You could also, I could imagine people saying that she suddenly retroactively gains it as soon as it becomes conscious on her part, but I don't see as much of an evidential basis for that. I would tend to go with one of the other options.
All right. Patrick, thank you very, very much for that very well-elaborated question, including an imaginary conversation between Mary and Martha. Next, Kimberly, this is also from email. My understanding is that during the canonization process, the body of the potential saint is exhumed, and if their body has not suffered corruption, that plays a role in their path towards sainthood. The question has to do with cremation. With the rise in acceptance and practice of cremation for Catholics, how would someone being a future incorruptible interact with the act of cremation? Would the body burn at all? If it would, are we destroying future incorruptibles by practicing cremation?
Well, it depends on what God wants. If God wants a body not to burn, it's not going to burn. I mean, look at Daniel's friends in the fiery furnace.
Right.
So if God really, really, really determines someone's body is not going to corrupt, then he could preserve it from being cremated. That's within the power of divine omniscience. I don't know of any cases of that happening when someone's died and chosen cremation, but I can't rule it out. In terms of the other possibility, I think it's quite possible that, you know, we might in some cases be cremating individuals who otherwise their bodies might have been incorrupt. And in part, I say that because there is such a thing as natural incorruption. It is not the case that everyone whose body is preserved, it's because of a miracle.
Okay.
There are situations where people's bodies will naturally desiccate or dry out in a way that leaves them looking, you know, fairly lifelike, but due to natural causes. And so when the church looks at a saint's body or a prospective saint's body to see if there are signs of incorruption, it doesn't take that as guaranteed proof that this person is a saint, because sometimes you have natural situations where they produce the same effect. It's just one piece of evidence among many that's taken into account in someone's cause for canonization. And so if there are cases where bodies naturally are preserved and some of those people get cremated, well, then the same thing would apply to someone who would have been supernaturally preserved, supernaturally incorruptible. If they chose to have their body cremated, well, then that's one piece of evidence the examiners of their cause for canonization won't have, but that doesn't mean God can't give other evidences that would lead to their canonization.
All right. Kimberly, thank you very, very much for that question. It's Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin today. Of course, our guest for that is Jimmy Akin, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers. By the way, we've got a brand new ebook for anybody out there who would like this new free ebook. It's called O Come Let Us Adore Him, an Advent Companion. You just go to shop.catholic.com, look for the banner at the top of the page to download your free copy. O Come Let Us Adore Him, an Advent Companion, free in ebook format right now at shop.catholic.com.
Miss a show? Make sure to catch up by downloading the podcast, available online at Catholic.com.
The Aquinas Writing Advantage Program is part of Homeschool Connections' set of online courses for your Catholic homeschool. Homeschool Connections' website is homeschoolconnections.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Catholic radio, I believe, is the greatest tool for evangelization that the church has today. And I know this because we hear from people all over the world that tell us all the time they came to faith in Christ, in the Catholic Church, through Catholic radio. Guy that lives right next door to you, he might not ask you about your Catholic faith, but he'll ask us. He'll call in and say, tell me about the Catholic Church.
Dr. David Anders thinks Catholic radio is important. So should you.
Welcome back on this Friday afternoon, Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin, our topic this hour. I'm Cy Kellett, your host, Jimmy Akin, our guest. Jimmy's book, The Bible, is a Catholic book on sale now over at shop.catholic.com. When I say Jimmy's book, I just mean his latest book. Christian, by email, has the following question, Jimmy.
Okay.
I was wondering if Jimmy could speculate...
I'm good at speculating.
Oh, yes, he can speculate on a presupposed notion on the salvation of Erwin Rommel. Rommel was a Catholic German general during World War II, Desert Fox, and supposedly involved in the plot to kill Hitler. Because of the nature of the cause he fought for, would his Catholic faith have, assuming he stayed true to its tenets, been sufficient for his salvation?
So I can't obviously give a concrete answer about Erwin Rommel or anybody else in terms of was he saved for reals or not, but I can speculate. So as framed, the question says, if Erwin Rommel was true to the tenets of his Catholic faith, would he have been saved? Yes, same as anybody else.
Okay.
The question is, was he or do we have evidence or how reasonable would the claim be in light of the evidence that he stayed true to his Catholic faith or to the principles of it? Well, being a Nazi, kind of, you know, inconsistent with certain principles of the Catholic faith.
Okay.
On the other hand, just because someone was serving in the German military at the time does not mean that they were a supporter of Nazi ideology.
Right.
Like Joseph Ratzinger, who was compelled to be a member of the German army, even though he and his family were very anti-Nazi in their ideology. Also, there are situations where another principle of the Catholic faith is that if one engages in warfare, it needs to be a just war. And the calculus of is this a just war is something that falls primarily on the leaders of the state because individuals are not in a position to usually to have a full appreciation of all the evidence for and against the justness of a war. But individuals do have some responsibility to make that determination. And there are situations where an individual could say, I'm sorry, this war does not appear to me to be just, and so I can't in good conscience fight in it. Well, that's a matter of individual conscience, and conscience can be erroneous. So even if Rommel said to himself, well, I think it's legitimate for Germany to embark upon this war because we need to reunify for the sake of European stability. We need to reunify all of the different German-speaking peoples.
Yeah.
So after the annexation or Anschluss of Austria, well, we still have these German speakers in Czechoslovakia and Poland, and we need to, reassimilate them so that we're not divided and so that we don't have continual battles over these territories, and we need a buffer zone for security. I mean, if he believed that it was legitimate to go to war to achieve those ends, well, he may have been wrong. And in the opinion of most people in the West, he would have been wrong, but he would have been in innocent conscience if he just sincerely thought this. And
this was
through no
thing.
Fault of his own, he was mistaken. He had an erroneous conscience, in which case he wouldn't be held responsible by God for acting on his erroneous conscience. Because if you sincerely believe something, well, you do need to follow your conscience. Although you need to make sure that you've done your best to ensure that it's a correct conscience.
Yes.
Rather than just going with what you want to be true.
Yeah, Right.
And that's a subjective matter that can be known ultimately only between Erwin Rommel when he was alive, if him, and God. Then, so we've got a couple pieces of evidence there. Another piece of evidence, though, is the claim that he was involved in an assassination attempt on Hitler. Well, that kind of goes in the other direction, that would be supportive of the idea of his salvation, because it would indicate that he perceived Hitler as a great evil that needed to be eliminated, mm-hmm. and didn't see another practical way of doing it, and was therefore willing to participate in one of the plots against Hitler, which put you at severe risk.
And if I may, that mm-hmm. would be what you might call tyrannicide or something.
Yes.
And that it can also be justified, just like war can in some instances.
It can be, yes. And so, and it can even involve, because it involves taking great personal risk,
yeah.
and so forth. And even you can be risking those around you too, because they may say, okay, now that this plot has been discovered, we're not only going to kill the plotters, we're going to kill all their families too.
Right.
And to make an example. Mm-hmm. And so there could actually be a great deal of personal heroism and courage that's displayed in pursuing a tyrannicide. And in fact, when some of the plots against Hitler were discovered, there were draconian measures taken to make right. examples and right. so forth. So that's a piece of evidence that could be perceived as pointing in the other direction. Not necessarily, though, because you can... Just because you correctly identify somebody as a great evil that needs to be eliminated, like Hitler, and this is the only practical way to neutralize that evil, doesn't mean your motives are good, because you still might yeah. have something else, like, oh, and I want to replace
yeah,
him.
Yeah, right. I guess he'd be perfect for the job.
Right. So, yeah. So can't say ultimately, but those are some of the factors. But ultimately, if Rommel was like anybody else, if he was living up to the degree of light he had been given at the end of his life, regardless of what had happened before.
Yeah.
But if at the end of his life he was doing what he understood he needed to do to please God, then God would accept that and forgive him his sins, just like anybody else.
Thank you very, very much, Christian, for that email. The next comes from the Petrie family. If someone went into a church and removed the consecrated Eucharist from the church, would it be a matter of kidnapping or theft?
Or something else?
Yeah, come on, Jimmy, keep throwing.
So it's going to depend on the definitions that you use for kidnapping and theft, because and different systems are going to define things differently. In terms of civil law, for example, here in the United States, civil law would look at a situation where someone takes the Eucharist without permission as a situation of theft, mm-hmm. because, but not as kidnapping, because civil law in the United States does not recognize religious claims like this is Jesus Christ, and so they don't recognize it as a person.
Mm-hmm.
The Eucharist as a person, and so it wouldn't count as kidnapping. Also, there are other questions one would need to ask, because the situation of the Eucharist is different than other situations. In the case of kidnapping, classically, it's not just theft where you're stealing a person. It's also understood as in some way hindering that person, because if you take them, they're going to experience a number of effects, like they may be terrified, so there's mental anguish that's inflicted. Their movements are restricted, so they can't go one place if you're confining them to another place.
Yeah.
But those don't apply to Jesus in the Eucharist, because Jesus is glorified in heaven. His happiness is perfect. He's not going to be mentally traumatized mm-hmm. by someone moving the Eucharist from one place to another without authorization. He may recognize that that's a sin and this person shouldn't be doing it, but he's not going to be like afraid and terrified and stuff like that, like a normal kidnap victim.
Right.
Also, he's already multi-locating. And he's omnipresent, and he can cause anything he wants to happen anywhere in the world. So you're kind of not restricting him from being in other places by having him in this one place mm-hmm. the way you would a normal kidnap victim. And so even if you, so again, you're going to have to think about the definition you're going to be using for kidnapping, because the ordinary definition of stealing a person does not capture all of the reality of what happens in Jesus's case. But the church does have another category in which to place this act that isn't simply theft or kidnapping. It's sacrilege. So this is an act, and in terms of how the church would look at this, the church in terms of canon law would say this is an act of sacrilege. In fact, it's one of the most sacrilegious crimes there is. Mm-hmm. And the church has special provisions for dealing with this kind of sacrilege. What sacrilege is it's treating something sacred as if it were profane. And yes, since the Eucharist is Jesus himself, it's as sacred as you can get. And therefore, to treat it as treat it in an improper way, like stealing it from a church, is a great sacrilege. And that would be the category that the church's law would primarily look at this as.
All right, Petrie family, thank you very, very much for that question. It's Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin today. And up next is a question from Amanda, who says, Saint Apollonia leapt into a fire. They would have tossed her in anyways because she wouldn't renounce her faith. Where do you draw the line between martyrdom and suicide?
This is an interesting case. Saint Apollonia was a Christian living in Alexandria, Egypt, so right up at the mouth of the Nile on the Mediterranean coast. And she lived in the 200s. She died apparently an advanced age in the year 249. And unlike a lot of legends about saints, you know, especially in these early periods, you'll hear a saint so-and-so, this happened to them and they were martyred. And a lot of those, you kind of go, how do we really know this? You know, do we have good eyewitness sources? And in some cases, the answer is no, this could be a legend. Not in hers. In the case of St. Apollonia, we have a letter from her bishop, Dionysius, or Denis of Alexandria, who wrote about the sufferings that his flock had experienced. This was in the last year of the reign of the Emperor Philip the Arab. Yeah, there was an Arab emperor. And he was knocked over by his successor, Decius, who inaugurated a persecution of Christians. But Philip was favorable to Christians. In fact, according to some accounts, within a century of his death, he was a Christian, would mean he was a Christian before Constantine. But even if he wasn't, he was at least favorable to Christians. So Philip the Arab was not interested in stirring up a persecution against Christians. But in the last year of his reign, riots broke out in Alexandria, and the Alexandrians, on their own, without authorization from the emperor, began to persecute Christians. And they did a number of things, including to St. Apollonia, that Bishop Denis talks about in his letter, which we have extensive quotations from.
Okay.
And he says they took St. Apollonia and smashed out all of her teeth by striking her in the mouth. And then they built a fire in front of the city and told her, we're going to burn you alive if you don't say these blasphemous things and renounce your Christian faith. And then the Greek says something that's a little interesting. I haven't been able to fully pursue it, but it gets translated different ways. Some will say she seemed to shrink, or she asked for a delay or something like that. But the result was they released her enough that she just went ahead and jumped in the fire and perished. And so the way the question is described by Amanda, it's accurate, and this is a real historical circumstance that we have good evidence for. She would have been burned alive based on all the evidence and chose to end things more quickly. So what's the morality of that? Well, a parallel is potentially found in what happened on 9/11. In the year 2000, because when the Twin Towers were struck, if you go back and you look at photographs and videos, you'll see people jumping.
Yeah.
And so there was a question that got raised about what's the morality of that? Is that just suicide? Well, in some cases, the answer could have been yes, but not necessarily, because the the fuel from the plane engines and stuff had caused this massive fire. And in order for something to count as suicide, you have to intend your death either as a goal in and of itself or as a means to another end. But your death could, you could undertake under a principle known as the law of double effect. You could undertake an action knowing it's going to lead to your death in all probability, but not have it be a means or an end. It could just be a side effect. And I'll tell you about that on the other side of the break.
Okay. Hang on there, Amanda, who asked that question. More on St. Apollonia and the question of martyrdom and suicide while we continue with Jimmy Akin. Oh, excuse me, Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin right after this.
Everybody's favorite Catholic outer space delivery pilots return for their greatest in the brand new graphic novel Weapons of War. Fresh from saving the solar system in The Truth Is Out There and saving the timeline of salvation history in The Big Picture, Brendan and Irk land in a magnificent domed city on Mars for what is supposed to be a simple shuttle job. But soon they find themselves caught up in a sinister assault on faith and freedom. Will Mars be lost to the enemy? Brendan and Irk's only hope for the flight is in the power of God's sacramental gifts. A totally new kind of Catholic resource for apologetics and evangelization, The Truth Is Out There series combines the visual excitement and quirky humor of graphic novels with solid popular philosophy and theology. The result is a series in which everyone from teens to adults can find accessible answers to questions about God, the soul, true happiness, and much more. Order your copy of Weapons of War today by calling 844-239-4952, by visiting shop.catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
If you're a Catholic who sometimes gets intimidated by the Bible, Jimmy Akin's The Bible is a Catholic Book will help you better understand and take pride in this gift that God gave the world through the church. Don't let anyone tell you otherwise. Catholics are the original Bible Christians. Order your copy of The Bible is a Catholic Book today by calling 844-239-4952, by visiting shop.catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Welcome back to Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin today on Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host, and we're talking about St. Apollonia, a actually well-attested ancient saint who died in the 3rd century in Alexandria, Egypt. And she, as she's being martyred, she leaps into the fire. So the question is that suicide or is that martyrdom
something else.
Or something else?
Yeah. Okay. So I see you've got the something else bug there. Okay. Good to cover your bets. So I was illustrating a principle that I devoted significant thought to after the events of 9/11, where you had people leaping from the Twin Towers.
Right.
Now, if someone's saying, I just want to die and that's their goal, well, then that could be construed morally as suicide. But it doesn't have to be, because it's possible to undertake an action knowing it's likely to lead to your death, where it's where your foreseen death is a side effect of the action rather than being an intended means or end. The classic example of that is leaping on a grenade in a foxhole to save your comrades, because you foresee that if I leap on this grenade, I'm probably going to die.
Right.
But I don't will my death. I'm not trying to die, and I'm not dying in order to bring about something else. If it so happens that I live, great.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
And in the same way, someone in the Twin Towers being menaced by flames could say, I don't want to die.
Mm-hmm.
But I also don't want to be burned hideously by these flames. So I'm going to take the only course of action that's open to me and jump out of this window, knowing I'm likely to die as a result. But that is not what I'm intending to happen. And it's not a means to some other end.
Right.
If I miraculously survive, awesome.
Yeah.
In which case, that's not a suicide. It's an action where one is likely to die and may foresee that one is going to die, but the death is a side effect, not a means or an end to something else. Not an end in itself and not a means to some other end. And so if we look at the case of someone like St. Apollonia, well, number one, she's being martyred. She's just had all of her teeth smashed out, according to her bishop. And so she's under physical and psychological duress. And that of itself could mean she's in a muddled state mentally.
Right.
And if she's in a muddled state mentally, she's not going to be fully responsible for her actions, and God will not hold her accountable, even if this would be understood as suicide. Also, you have to look at what's the level of doctrinal development in her age regarding suicide. That would be another situation that you'd have to take into account in evaluating what happened with her. But it's not a slam dunk that this is a suicide. Because she could say, well, what I don't want to be further physically tortured. And so the action she's seeking to avoid is undue prolongation of her pain.
Yeah.
So she's saying, I don't want these guys to torture me anymore. It's like running from the flames in the Twin Towers. I don't want this to be stretched out any longer than it needs to be. That could be her intention. Also, she could be saying, in her heart, God can do miracles. And what a miracle it would be. God has done other miracles in connection with martyrdoms. If I jump in those flames and I'm not consumed, it could convert these people.
Yeah.
On the other hand, if I jump in these flames and it's God's will for me to be consumed, I accept that at his hand.
Yeah.
And in that case, she wouldn't be in she might be foreseeing that she's likely to die as a result of jumping in the flames, but that could still be a side effect, not something she's desiring as an end in itself, and her death not being a means to some other end. And it could simply be, I'm accepting the fate here, I'm just not prolonging it.
Yeah.
Just like Jesus tells Judas, what you're going to do, do quickly.
Yeah.
Which you could say, oh, well, that was Jesus going to the cross willingly, and he should have, that could be suicide, and he should have avoided as long as he could. Well, that wasn't Jesus's understanding.
Yeah.
You can want to get your suffering over quickly and even take actions to get it over more quickly, like saying what you're going to do, do quickly, or in St. Apollonia's case, perhaps leaping into the fire and maybe being open to, living and God even performing a miracle here. So it's not a slam dunk case that this is a suicide. And even if it were, she's under extreme mental duress, and God is merciful to people who are under extreme mental duress.
Amen. Amen. Thank you very much, Amanda, for that question. Let's go to, before I do that, it's Friday. So that means a new Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World.
Yeah.
What have you been doing lately on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World?
We just had a weird question show last Friday.
Oh, right.
And
we
had Frank Olson's mysterious death apparently at the hands of the CIA.
All right.
And coming out this week, we have the biggest, or should have come out just today, we have the biggest mystery in Australian history, according to some accounts, the mystery of the Somerton Man.
Oh,
who was a gentleman who died back in the 1940s under mysterious circumstances, and there's good evidence he may have been a spy. Also, next week we're going to have fatal UFO encounters in Brazil. And
that's one of my favorite titles yet.
Yeah.
Fatal UFO encounters in Brazil.
And then for Christmas, the mystery of the Magi from the Bible.
Hey, all right. Amen. You did Number Stations not too long ago, too, right?
Yeah, did Number Stations.
Yeah. We should do that sometime, just for the entire 2 hours of Catholic Answers, just broadcast Numbers.
Read Numbers?
So, yeah, right. Or we could read the Book of Numbers.
We could. It takes takes a little more than an hour, but sure.
All right. Mark from Melbourne, Florida. I don't know. I have heard a theory that alien abductions could be demons pretending to be aliens. This is supported by the fact that in a lot of these cases, anti-religious messages are given by the aliens. Could this be possible?
Sure, all kinds of things are possible. So is it possible for demons to impersonate aliens? Sure. It's also possible for aliens to impersonate demons.
This is getting twisted.
Humans
now.
Even impersonate demons on occasions, and demons impersonate angels. So it's sort of impersonations all around.
Yeah.
In terms of beyond possibility, if we want to look at probability, that's a whole nother question, and we need to look at concrete evidence. And this is what I don't have. I sometimes hear people say things like, as in this case, there are anti-religious messages that aliens give us, and that's signs that they're demons. Well, okay, what are we talking about? Where's the evidence of that? I mean, I haven't seen that in the... I can think of several different things that would... that could potentially fall into this category.
Okay.
But in the cases of many so-called reported alien abductions, like the Betty and Barney Hill abductions, the ones that kicked it off back in the 1960s, they didn't report the aliens saying anything about religion.
Yeah.
You know, so there's no...
And the premise there might be weak in itself. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
What do you mean by anti-religious? Do you mean anti-Christian specifically? Well, that could mean they just have a different religion. But that doesn't mean someone who has a different religion from you doesn't mean that they're a demon. If you're talking to someone from India and they happen to be a Hindu, and they tell you something they believe, and it contradicts the Christian faith, it just means they're a Hindu, but they're still a human being. They're not a demon. And in the same way, if you had aliens who had a different religion and believed things contrary to Christianity, that doesn't mean they're demons. That just means they have a different religion.
Oh, how interesting. I never thought about alien religion.
Yeah. So if like you're dealing with a Klingon and he tells you that the Klingons killed their early gods and the honored dead go to Stovokor.
Yeah.
Or if you don't die with honor, you go on the barge of the dead to the bad place. Well, those are Klingon ideas about the afterlife, but that doesn't mean Klingons are demons. They would just be aliens with a different religion.
Got it.
So we have to look carefully here. And I have, despite the fact I hear people making these claims about alien encounters, and I don't know that any of these encounters are real to start with, but assuming they are, I don't have good evidence of specifically demonic things being said. So, you know, I'm open to this possibility, but I don't have good evidence for this possibility.
All right. Mark, I hope that satisfied you. He did have a second part to his question.
Okay.
I'll give it to you real quick before we have to take a break. I have also been intrigued by the theory that the gods worshipped in antiquity, like he says Mayan or Sumerian gods, may have been demons also. Would this fit with the Catholic belief system? Because how would God allow this if true?
Well, there are several possibilities, but basically, yeah, it would fit. In fact, the ideas behind that claim were essentially pioneered by the Church Fathers. In the ancient world, in the Greco-Roman world, you had a number of different terms for celestial beings. One of them was theos, which we translate in English as God. And the term theos could refer to the Olympian gods like Zeus and Hera and Apollo, or it could refer to the supreme god, the Aristotle's prime mover, you know, who is above even the Olympian gods. Then there was another category of what were known as daimones, from which we get demon.
Yeah.
And a daimon was a lower order spirit, could be good, could be bad, but a lower order spirit inferior to the gods, kind of like what we might think of as an angel. And humans could manipulate demons by magic. Now, they didn't have the Christian association of a demon is always a bad guy.
Okay.
The original meaning of the term, daimon, just meant like an inferior spiritual being that humans could relate to in magical or religious ceremonies. And so what happened was when Christian apologists started evangelizing, they said, look, you're right. There is this great God behind everything. But the problem is in this Olympian layer.
Yeah.
The Olympian ones aren't really deserving of the title Theos. They're not gods in that way. They're much inferior. They're just daimon. level beings. And so Zeus is a diamond level being, and Apollo is a diamond level being. And so these pagan gods are just demons. You shouldn't be worshiping them. They're inferior spiritual beings. In fact, from a Christian point of view, they're fallen angels.
Right, right.
And so this is a common view in Christian history and a common way of explaining why, when somebody prays to Zeus, you know, they may get the rain thereafter or something.
Right.
Because it's demons can have effect in the natural world. On the other hand, though, Jesus tells us that God sends his rain on the righteous and the unrighteous as well. So if someone is unrighteously praying to Zeus, but God knows that person needs rain for their crops, God can send them the rain anyway.
Yeah.
And Zeus may have nothing to do with it. So so there's not a single answer on this.
Yeah.
But it is a way of looking at things that's consistent with and has actually been used a lot in Christian history. And it would be part of God's providence, just like he allows other evil things to happen, because he knows he can ultimately bring about an equal or greater good by allowing that thing to happen.
All right. It's Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin. Mark, two great questions from Florida there. We got to take a quick break. We'll be right back with some more Weird Questions right after this.
There's only one. Catholic Answers Live.
Hi, I'm Brian Patrick. Join me, Dr. Matthew Bunsen, and Father Thomas Petrie for The Church Alive.
It's not a happy time at the moment in Washington and for the people who go to the Basilica.
Father, you mentioned a forensic investigation. Define forensic in this context.
I think it simply means they're going to be looking if there's any victims who have not come forward, if there's any substance to the allegations.
In other words, we're really digging down into what could be the allegations.
Yes.
The Church Alive, tomorrow, 7 a.m. and 1 p.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Go forth and preach the good news. It's not just a suggestion. If you want to take more seriously the command of Jesus to share the gospel with those around you, consider joining St. Paul Street Evangelization. It's a grassroots organization that brings the Catholic faith to the streets in a non-confrontational way. Visit our website, www.streetevangelization.com, to learn more. And don't forget to like us on Facebook. It's time to do our part.
Welcome back. Jimmy Akin's here. Jimmy's senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, the author of many things, including the new book, The Bible is a Catholic Book. If you're interested in the Bible and you want to just kind of know where did this book come from, who are the people that wrote it, what were they thinking about, and how did it all get assembled, is a great book for you. If you want to know more about your Catholic faith, a great book for you. And I'll tell you what, if you're a person who is not a Catholic, but you're just interested in understanding the books of the Bible in a more profound way and having a very respectful conversation. Jimmy's always respectful. He's not disrespectful of anyone except for, I can't think of anyone. I've tried to think of somebody, but I couldn't think of anyone.
I try not to be.
Yeah. You'll really enjoy this book. The Bible is a Catholic Book. You can get it now at shop.catholic.com. You can just get it by typing in The Bible is a Catholic Book and shopping wherever you shop. Next question for you, Jimmy. Michael from Puerto Rico.
Mm-hmm.
Jimmy, are you familiar with Isaac Asimov's short story, The Last Question?
Yes.
All right. Thank you for that question, Michael. Oh, it goes on. I read it for the first time when I was in my teens.
Yeah, I think that's when I read it too in high school.
The story has always fascinated me, but what I have trouble with is understanding the final sentence of the story. How do you understand the final sentence in the whole of the story? And what was the message Isaac Asimov was trying to convey?
Okay.
I don't know the last sentence, though.
I do.
Da, da, da.
So what happens in this short story is people build a computer, and they ask a question of it.
Oh.
And the question is not the great question of life, the universe, and everything, because we know the answer to that one.
Is it 47?
42.
42. I couldn't.
It is a similar situation where they build this supercomputer and they ask a question that is how can we avoid the heat death of the universe? So what heat death is a hypothetical state where as the universe continues to expand, the level of entropy constantly goes up. Entropy deals with the degree to which energy and matter are diffused. So if you have a bunch of matter and energy all contained in a small space, and then it and you let it go, it's going to start diffusing. And that's why stars shine.
I think I kind of remember this story. Okay. Yes.
And as entropy increases, energy and matter diffuse. And so if you let the universe run for trillions of years, it's eventually going to get in a very cold, thin state where the stars have burned out and the matter and energy is very scattered. And it's a very high entropy state. It's known as heat death. Well, excuse me. Well, the people who build the supercomputer ask it the question, how can we radically decrease the entropy of the universe? So, you know, we can stave off heat death, in other words, we can keep things going. And the computer says, answer, information is insufficient to formulate a meaningful answer at this time. And so we then advance in the short story by leaps through the centuries, and we see how human society changes, and they keep asking the computer, how can we radically reduce the entropy of the universe? And the, every time the computer, as which is itself getting more and more advanced, says, you know, insufficient information for a meaningful answer at this time. And eventually the human race kind of ascends and space and time end, but the super advanced computer is left in this timeless, spaceless void, still contemplating the original question. And since there's no one left to give the answer to, the computer decides to answer by demonstration, which will also produce someone who he's able to give the answer to. And the computer says, let there be light. And there was light. And that's the final sentence of the story.
Yeah.
And so so the computer has reversed heat death by creating a new universe in a low entropy state through let there be light. That's the solution. And so this is what's known in science fiction sometimes as a Shaggy God story. As opposed to a shaggy dog story.
Yeah,
right.
Right.
A Shaggy God story is one where you use science fiction concepts to explain something religious.
Yeah.
In
yeah.
this case, the beginning of the world. The other common one is, oh, guess what? The two astronauts are named Adam and Eve.
Right. Or who mourns for Adonis?
Well, that would be another similar one. Yeah. Although I was also going to say in one DC comic I read from the 70s, the two astronauts end up being named Krip and Ton. So you have these sci-fi things now in terms of as ways of exploring religious concepts. I'm not a big fan of this kind of story, and in fact most science fiction authors are not big fans of these because they're kind of cliche.
Yeah.
And in terms of why do they get written and what Asimov's point may have been, I don't know that Asimov had a point. Now, he was a secular individual of Jewish background. He didn't really believe in God, but he did explore religious concepts. And I don't think he's making a particular statement here. He's certainly not saying, I think this is how it really happened.
Yeah.
But he's just here's an interesting thing that could, you can kind of see how this would accomplish the same effect. And really what it's meant to do, and a reason, the reason behind a lot of Shaggy God stories is it's just meant to end your story on a note of wonder.
Yeah.
You know, that's really all that they're trying for. They're not trying to make some deep statement. They're just trying to give the ooh experience to the audience at the end.
Yeah.
Now, when this kind of science fiction exploration of a religious concept is done well, it can actually be of religious interest, because a principle that I've had for a long time in evaluating would this miracle be possible is, well, if I can think of a way to do it using advanced physics or science fiction physics, if I can think of a way to do it, then God knows at least that way.
Yeah,
and
right.
Probably lots of others. I can't say God used the way I thought of, but I can show a miracle is possible by thinking of a science fiction way to accomplish that miracle. And so there can be a religious as opposed to artistic interest to these stories, but they're usually not done that well. And in this case, it's like, so could our universe from a Christian perspective really have been created by a supercomputer that was built by inhabitants of a previous universe? And no, that's not the explanation for our universe.
No.
Well, I mean, could be, but not all of creation because all of creation has to be produced by an uncreated being. And even if there were a pocket somewhere where a machine reversed the entropy of a given pocket of creation, the machine is itself created. It's not the ultimate explanation for all of creation. You need an uncreated being for that.
Thank you very, very much for that interesting question, Michael, from Puerto Rico. Daniel follows with this question. I have been trying to read about the theological implications about finding out that aliens exist, and I was wondering if you had any idea how we might determine if any aliens we had met were fallen once we knew they had souls. And actually, I've got for soul, all I've got for souls is your suggestion of seeing whether they have a concept of God. Okay, so how would we be able to tell if aliens were fallen once we knew they had souls?
Okay. For further background on the theological implications of the discovery of intelligent alien life, you want to go listen to episode 55 of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, where we devote the entire hour to that.
Okay.
But in terms of answering this specific question, actually, when I talk about aliens and do they have a concept of God, I'm not really answering the question, do they have souls? All living things, according to the standard theological understanding, all living things have a soul. It's a question of what kind of soul does it have? In the case of plants, they have what are called vegetative souls that allow them to grow and reproduce and process energy, but, you know, not think. In the case of animals, they have what are called sensitive souls that allow them to feel and perceive things and also engage in a primitive form of reasoning of different levels. I mean, a butterfly is nowhere near as intelligent as a dog. And then humans have what are called rational souls, which allow us to have human-level reason. And we know that human-level souls survive death. The common opinion is, historically, has been that the lower kinds of souls don't, but at least ours does. Mm-hmm. And so if we met aliens, I would assume they have a soul. The question is it a rational soul or not? And if they display human level reason, you know, the ability to, even if their intelligence is different than ours, if it's approximately equal, I'm going to be inclined to say that, yeah, they've got a rational soul. And if they have the concepts of God and the afterlife, I would say, even if they don't understand them the way we do, I would say, and they have a spiritual destiny.
Okay.
Because they wouldn't have these concepts if they didn't. The existence of these concepts in their race indicates they have a spiritual destiny the same way we do. So the question of are they fallen would then be resolved in terms of a couple principles. One thing you have to look at is what are they naturally designed to do? Humans are naturally designed to have monogamous pairs. That's the ideal situation for raising human offspring. That is not true of lions. You know,
right.
Lions are not monogamous.
Yeah.
And so we'd have to look at them and we would have to take into account their behavior somewhat sophisticatedly. We'd have to say, okay, are they designed for this type of behavior? Because even though a particular behavior might be wrong for us to engage in, it might not be wrong for them.
Because their nature would be different.
Their nature is not human nature. It's different.
Right.
And so we couldn't determine are they fallen simply by are they doing things that would be sins for human beings.
No,
we'd have to figure out their nature and say, is this or in accord with their nature or not?
Yeah.
Now, part of that is going to be interviewing them and seeing do they have the concept of guilt. If they have the concepts like guilt and shame and a recognition they've done wrong, that is a good sign that they are fallen, because that's also the principal evidence that we're fallen and not simply just acting in accord with some nature. The fact that we have a conscience that says you did wrong is evidence that we are in fact fallen.
Jimmy Akin's book, The Bible is a Catholic Book. You can get it at shop.catholic.com. You should visit Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World by typing into the internet, Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. You'll be glad you did. Jimmy Akin, thank you very much for another weird hour.
Good hour.
That does it for us for this Friday. Jesus Christ is the light of the nations. And we'll see you next time on Catholic Answers Live.